accession number 21063, rule 1.
Squadron Leader Lee, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
Born in Birmingham, Erdington, Birmingham, England.
Which year was this?
1915.
Did both your parents come from Birmingham?
No, they both came from Yorkshire.
Whereabouts?
One came from his family, had a hotel in Harrogate, and my wife, I don't really recall what her family did.
Your mother?
My mother. Yes.
But they both came from Harrogate, did they?
Both came from Leeds and Harrogate area, Leeds and Otley.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Birmingham?
In Birmingham, yes.
Which school did you go to there?
Went to King Edward VI High School, which was originally, when I went to it, in the main street of Birmingham, the centre of town.
How old were you when you finished there?
I was 17.
In 1932?
Presumably, yes.
Did you then get a job?
The school sent me on to work for a family of old boys who'd been at the school themselves. Both had been in the First World War, both were majors and very keen that to get somebody from the school to carry on. They had no sons in their families at all. So I worked for them for 7 years. During which time I volunteered to join the Royal Air Force Volunteer Reserve at their suggestion.
What appealed to you about that?
Well, of course, I'd been very keen as a boy reading books about the flying exploits in the First World War, and when this offer of joining the Volunteer Reserve to fly it in your spare time from home and going to a local centre to learn to fly, it was very appealing, and my employers thought so too.
How old were you when you joined up?
I was about 19. And I was the fourth person to join the Volunteer Reserve.
What kind of experiences and training did you have pre-war with the Volunteer Reserve?
The first thing I did was go away for a two-month course to Perth in Scotland for the first course of the Volunteer Reserve. And there I went together with Ginger Lacey, who became quite famous later on, and with whom I flew during the war. We did 2 months there to learn to fly and to get our wings, then returning home to fly at weekends and evenings at the local centre, which, from where I lived in Birmingham, happened to be Coventry.
Did you find it easy to fly?
Well, I went solo in about 7 hours, which was average for everybody else. And then in my later on, I was graded above average by my instructor in Coventry.
Any memories about Ginger Lacey that we could record, please?
Well, of course, he was very, very much his own person and very independent about other people's views. When we were once at a lecture in Perth, somebody decided it was amusing to lean over and set fire to his hair. So he sat there with his hair burning and wouldn't put it out until the fellow came and set fire to his hair, put it out for him. That was the kind of man he was.
Was he like as a flyer?
Well, of course, he was very good as a flyer. He had a great number of successes. We flew together all through the Battle of France and then through the Battle of Britain. And then he went off to the Far East and I went to East Africa, Central Africa.
Which squadron did you first join?
When I was flying at the weekends, I did so many hours flying that the Air Force thought they would like me to go to a regular squadron. And so again in peacetime, at the beginning of 1939, they asked my employers to give me 6 months off to go to a fight, to go to a squadron to fly. So for 6 months, I flew with 111 Squadron under Harry Broadhurst from Northolt, and then later on as a sergeant pilot. Then I was commissioned. So in April I went to 43 Squadron with Peter in Peter Townsend flight there at Tangmere. And there, Ginger Lacey was also there serving as a sergeant pilot, VR, Volunteer Reserve, with Number 1 Squadron, which was also their home base, on the same home base.
Had you expected in the late 30s that a war would break out?
Never occurred to me. I was just really more interested in learning to fly and being a good pilot.
Would your decision to join the RAFVR have changed if you had expected a war?
I can't think it would have changed in any way. Because, and then when I did go along to fly in a regular squadron, we were practicing attacks and formation flying and attacks and all kinds of manoeuvres there, so that you were being geared for combat. And we're looking forward to combat as things got more threatening as war approached.
Did you visit Germany before the war?
Never, no.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Of course, yes. I mean, I was thinking I was at the Volunteer Reserve Centre at lunchtime when we heard the word 11 o'clock, I think it was. We heard the declaration of war.
How did you feel about the news?
Well, having been brought up with the war in my background, my father was in the Royal Navy, and then having read so much about it, the light-hearted way in which the aircrew, at least, or the fighter pilots approached the things in those days, we adopted the same attitude. We were really looking forward to it.
Had your father been a professional sailor?
No, he was in the merchant marine or in the naval volunteer reserve, naval reserve, as a gunner.
What do you remember happening to you next after Chamberlain declared war?
Immediately, I was taken from 43 Squadron, which is an ordinary frontline fighter squadron, and sent to 501 Squadron, an auxiliary squadron, which had lacked experienced pilots. By this time I'd done 6 months in a regular fighter squadron as a volunteer, and auxiliaries needed people who had some experience. Although when I arrived I was the most junior officer in the squadron. The others were all flying officers and flight lieutenants, but I was the one with the flying experience who'd flown Hurricanes day and night.
What had you thought to the Hurricane as an aircraft to fly?
Like every Hurricane pilot would tell you the same, that it's a marvellous aircraft to fly, a gentleman's aircraft, a sporting aircraft, and it will stand up, it will resist ill treatment, both by the enemy and by itself on landing. But it's very rugged and very reliable.
Where did you find 501 Squadron?
501 Squadron was at Filton, their home base. That was September 1939.
What kind of reception did you get at the unit?
Well, much to my surprise, they first wanted to give me a flying test to see whether I could fly at all. So they made me fly, which is an aircraft I'd never seen before, a fairy battle, with one of their instructors to fly around there to see if I was capable of flying, although I already had over 200 hours on Hurricanes, and their own average on Hurricanes was about 5 hours.
How did you get on with the ferry battle?
Well, I got it round and got down again in one piece anyway.
What do you remember happening next to you?
Well, the squadron, we continued training, and I tried to give them some of the advantages, some of the training I'd received already in the regular Air Force. And then we were suddenly transferred back to Tangmere, where I'd just come from, as a squadron, and we were put on standby to go immediately to any emergency area where the squadrons were needed. So we first of all rumoured we were going to Finland, and then we were going to Norway, and then we were going to France, and then back to Norway. We never moved until the day the phony war finished in early May 1940, and overnight we were given orders, and next morning we were straight off to France.
Where did you go to in France?
Well, a little town called Bettenville near Reims.
Do you remember any of the personalities who were with you in the squadron at that time?
Well, of course, the regular... There was, as I've said before, there was General Lacey, who was still a sergeant pilot. The officers of the auxiliaries, who were the flight commanders and the section leaders, because they were more senior, were all just local residents of Bristol. And then it was made up with another auxiliary... another volunteer reserve officer, Peter Hares, and a flight sergeant, which was quite rare, who was an ex-boy from the Royal Air Force Halton, called Morphill. And together we formed a fairly good unit, and immediately we got engaged the very first, within hours of arriving back in France.
Can you describe that engagement, please?
Well, the engagement was more by chance than anything else. We were on the ground, and some German aircraft just happened to fly by on their way back from a bombing raid, we believe. So one of our officers, flying officer pickup, took off immediately, and within sight of the ground, shot one of these Dorniers down. And... All the air crew jumped out, and we were captured.
And you went up as well?
Not on that occasion, no.
What kind of facilities could Reims Airfield offer at that time?
None at all. They had a munition hut at the bottom of the field, which was purely a field and nothing else, and the ground crew slept in tents, and we, the officers, managed to commandeer a small cafe 1,000 yards down the road, which we used as a mess and for sleeping purposes.
Did you get a welcome from the French?
Hardly saw the French. We were out on the airfield all the time.
What do you remember happening next in France?
Well, of course, it wasn't like a controlled battle where we had ground control giving us information on where enemy raids were coming in so we could go and intercept them. We were merely told from time to time to go off and patrol and look for the enemy, which we did. And we were flying around the ground on patrol lines near the French border. When we were lucky, and the first 3 days we made three major interceptions of the enemy. And that's when we got our first victories and lost our first pilots.
Can you describe each of those three interceptions in turn, please?
Well, the first one, the essence of this, in all this, is that I was known later on in the squadron as Hawkeye, because when we were on these particular patrols, the squadron were flying in this tight formation, and I was doing what we call Arsene Charlie, rear cover, for the squadron, which meant instead of flying in the formation, concentrating on flying in the formation, you were free to rove backwards and forwards behind the squadron, firstly to protect them from attack and warn them if any attack came in, and secondly, it gave you the opportunity of looking around for any enemy that might be available as a target. And on the very first patrol there, we were below cloud, and I was weaving, and I happened to see through the cloud a huge formation of aircraft immediately above us, through the cloud. And so I went up in front and signaled that there was an enemy up there, and we climbed up through the cloud and came out just behind this formation of about 40 Heinkels. So we went in and attacked. We lost two pilots, and we got about four of the Heinkels confirmed, and got a bit shot up here and there ourselves. Only bombers, though, no fighters, just a big formation of bombers. Then the next day, exactly the same, on patrol, again, myself doing the weaving, I spotted bomb bursts on the ground and traced these to four Dorniers which were flying below us. So I went up in front of the formation and again and waved and pointed down. So I turned off and went down and then got into position of behind these Dorniers, which had changed into a defence formation, and looked around for my support for the other lads. Not a soul to be seen. They'd apparently taken my signal as being going back to base. We had radio, but we were, at that time, in those early days in France, it was recommended we didn't use our radios in order not to betray our presence to the Germans. We didn't think they knew we were there. So my hand signals didn't work in this case. Anyway, I was so close to these bombers by this time, I couldn't do anything else but carry on. So I shot one down, which was confirmed by the French artillery, and got another one smoking. And I got 37 strikes on my own aircraft, which didn't do any harm at all. So then I just came back and landed again. And they're almost exactly the same happened the next day, only this time they were ME-110s. And when I went up in front and signaled down, everybody understood what I was doing, and we all went down. And we got a couple of those. So those were the first 3 days in France.
Seems extraordinary that on the second occasion your aircraft was so shot up without doing any harm.
Well, I did tell you the Hurricane was a very sturdy aircraft. I mean, the shots were into the engine bearings, and we had the wings were covered with canvas in those early days, and slots and lots of cuts in the wings, which didn't seem to affect the flying capability of the aircraft at all.
What do you remember happening next?
Well, we then we got a sudden signal. We had to move immediately. The Germans were only 12 miles away, so we moved back, and we flew down to an aerodrome called Anglure near Troyes, T-O, and we were there again in another field, and then this well-known pilot, Johnny Gibson, joined us there as a replacement. Was, as I said, we'd already lost about three of our frontline pilots to start with, and we flew from there. We were engaged off and on nearly every day, in one form or another. Again, very seldom a proper interception of a large formation with ourselves flying in to attack it, because there were chance encounters all the time.
Do you remember any specific incidents from those chance encounters?
Well, only the specific incident, of course, was myself being shot down for the first time. Again, I've dived after some Heinkels that disappeared into a cloud. And so I followed them, so hoping we'd all come out on the other side of the cloud and I'd get a clear shot of them. But in the cloud, something hit me, and never knew what it was, whether I flew into another aircraft or whether I was hit by a chance shot from one of them. I can't say. Anyway, my aircraft, the engine blew up and the prop stopped. And in this cloud, I just lost control. So all I could do was to get out. When I tried to get out, I was diving fast. The wind blew me back into the cockpit to begin with, and then the aircraft turned over and I fell out and hit the tailplane with my leg, so that then I came out the bottom of the cloud and pulled the chute and landed in the middle of a forest full of French second line troops who captured me, and then when they found out I was on the right side, everyone, all the Frenchmen gave me a big kiss, and I was, and then they sent me back to the squadron.
Were you injured at all?
My leg was injured as much as, like, very, very difficult to walk, and I also got a bullet in my hand, which meant I was, actually, this was by now early June, and we were going backwards, we'd moved back again by now to Le Mans, and there I was. Wasn't hospitalised. I had the bullet. I had my finger sewn up. I wasn't able to fly for the last 5 days in France. So I just went back with the squadron until we got to Saint-Malo, where a little boat called the Hull Trader was lying in the docks, waiting for the tide to fill the docks up so they could open the gates. And we got on this boat and sat there, hoping German bombers weren't going to come. Until they opened the gates and off we sailed, went back to Torquay.
What was the land journey like from Le Mans to the coast?
Well, we fortunately were never strafed, but it was very, very congested, and the people were running out of petrol and then wrecking trucks, leaving trucks there, so the road was pretty obstructed. Anyway, we got through to Le Mans. And in Le Mans, whilst waiting for this to embark there.
Not Le Mans.
At Saint-Malo, waiting to embark there. Nearby there was an aerodrome, and a French officer's mess. And we went there to try and get something to eat at lunchtime. And then whilst we were there, there was an announcement on the television, on the radio, about the surrender of France. And all these French officers were putting their arms around one another and weeping and spread, and they played the Marseillaise and everything else. And then they said, "We've all surrendered, and you've got to surrender with us, you see." So, but they wanted us to stay there and wait for the Germans. But we went on down to Saint-Malo port and got on the boat and came home.
Did you feel inclined to surrender?
never occurred to us. No. All we wanted to do was to get flying again, get healthy again so we could fly. The squadron itself flew to Jersey, but they only stayed there one day, and then they flew on to England.
What happened to you once you were back in England?
Well, it was about 10 days before I could actually use my hand properly again. But then I had 10 days leave, and then I rejoined the squadron at Croydon, where we reformed the squadron, and we got new Hurricanes. We only got about 7 Hurricanes out of the 15 or 16 we took to France. Only about 7 came back in good condition. So we had new Hurricanes and went to Middle Wallop and started doing channel patrols from there.
How were they conducted?
Well, they were, again, there was still shipping going up the channel, so we would try to protect the shipping from the German raiders. So there was just the occasional interception of somebody trying to bomb one of the raiders, and then that was quite an amusing incident happened during that time. Hares, who had been with us all through and had been in every engagement, but never managed to get himself credited with a victory, although he'd been shooting away as good as, and probably had hit people. Anyway, there was a Dornier attacking the ship, and his section got this Dornier and it began to smoke, but it still flew on and on and on. So his flight commander said, "Harry, go on, and you shoot this one down. It's yours." Hare's got round there, and he got behind this aircraft and pulled in close to get a really good heavy shot. And before he could press the button, they all jumped out, and the aircraft went to the sea, so he didn't get that victory either.
How did you like doing channel patrols?
Well, I mean, sometimes, you know, if you have any imagination, the engine never runs as smoothly when you're 40 miles out to sea than it does when you're over the coast. But it's all right. when you've got a thing as reliable as a Rolls-Royce engine.
Any other incidents from this time?
Well, I mean, there's not particular incidents there. I mean, there still was not, nothing much was happening. When the shipping stops coming through the channel regularly, the Germans stopped these patrols, so nothing really happened then for a few weeks, until then the squadron moved forward to Gravesend, where we were stationed there from the beginning of July. And Gravesend was our, it was a little private aerodrome, and we used it for headquarters. But every morning at dawn, we flew down to Hawkinge, which is just behind Folkestone. And there we were sat at readiness all day.
What did sitting at readiness involve?
Well, sitting at readiness, I mean, there were all stages of readiness to standby. And there's scramble. One is 15 minutes readiness and 30 minutes readiness. Means you have to be ready to take off within that time. And then when you're ready to stand by, you have to be off the moment the word, when the moment the word comes. Because there we were under the control of the central intelligence system for the run by the radar, which gave us the position of raids, of German raids coming in. And we were able to go directly to the area affected, as distinct from patrolling around the sky looking for the enemy. And we did that there all through July and all through August and right and on until September.
Was there much tension being at readiness and standby?
Well, no. I mean, most of us were fairly tired, and while you were at readiness, at 30-minute ready, you were probably asleep in a deck chair, waiting, and then of course, waiting for something to happen. And then the telephone would ring. There were four, sometimes four squadrons on the at Hawkinge, and everyone dispersed in a separate area with a control tent with a telephone, and there was one circuit for the telephone system, and that was so for the first squadron there was one ring on the telephone, for the second squadron there was two rings on the phone, third squadron there was three rings and four rings. So when you're sitting there and the fellow rings once, you're number three, and it rings, you say, well, that's them. No, but no, then it rings twice, and then you see, and then it rings three times, and you're just getting ready to go, and it rings four times, so it's the fourth squadron. So that was a bit of tension in that. Because we could, from standby, we could and were off the ground in 1.5 minutes from sitting in our deck chairs to being in the aircraft and off the ground.
How far from you were the aircraft?
50 yards or 100 yards, I mean, so 100 yards. But there was your aircraft just sitting there ready, you see, with your parachute and your helmet and everything all in position in the aircraft. So all you had to do was run out there, get in, and then your mechanic who was standing on the wing would give you the straps and the helmet, and you have it on there, and then you plug your radio. Your radio's plugged in, your helmet's already sitting in front of you to put on, and you're immediately in contact, and visually, we'll see the squadron leader would always usually hold his hand up until everybody was ready, they put their hands up, and then it was a grass aerodrome, so we were able to take off line abreast across the aerodrome without looking to go down a particular runway.
So it was a bit like a boat race start.
Exactly.
Can you take me through your combat experiences one by one in the Battle of Britain, please?
Well, far from the odd individual attack, interception, where just one aircraft would get the biggest and the most vividly remembered of mine was when we intercepted a formation, a big formation of Stukas coming to bomb Dover Harbour. And we were about the same level as they were. And the moment we made contact, they were in position, so they all went to a steep dive to bomb Dover Harbour. We immediately put our noses down and went down after them. When we got down nearly to ground level, and they levelled out and dropped their bombs, the Dover defences opened up, so we got the Dover defences with all their anti-aircraft and their little rockets and coming up towards us, and we were diving down on the Stukas. We all went through the middle of this. One of our own people was shot down as we went through that, and then we followed them out to sea. I shot a Stuka right down in the very middle of the exit to Dover Harbour, and using most.